Hi, I'm Stacey Evans. I'd like to welcome you to the program this afternoon. On behalf of the Virginia Foundation, I'd like to welcome you to the program this afternoon, the producer of the Festival of the Book. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones. And also, if you are a social media person, how's the mic? Am I too close? I'm not used to talking into such a thing. Does it sound fine? Thank you. There's a hashtag, VA Book 2016. If you do any of that type of social media, please share. Also, the program is free of charge, but not free of cost. So we love your support. And there is an online donation button at vabook.org. The web link is there. And there are giving envelopes at the Omni information desk. So if you find yourself at the Omni, you can find a place where you can write a check. And it would be appreciated to support the festival for years to come. Your feedback is also appreciated. So in the back on the right, there is a handful of evaluations. And if you would fill out those evaluations, we'd appreciate that as well. So let's see. Following the program, there will be book sales in the back by both Robert Llewellyn and Carolyn Rousseau, who I'm about to introduce. Please support our authors through the festival. Okay, so today's program is From Sea to Sky, Micro and Macro Perspectives in Photography, featuring Carolyn Rousseau and Robert Llewellyn. Carolyn is a photographer and museum specialist from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Her work has been exhibited internationally and has appeared in numerous publications. She is here today sharing her fourth book, Art and the Airport Tower, and will discuss the potential for photographs to represent our world on the page. Robert has been making photographs for over 40 years. He works just outside of Charlottesville in his home studio, overlooking the Rivanna River. His photographs have been featured in numerous exhibitions and books. Today is sharing the most recent book in which he photographed Seeing Seeds, a journey into the world of seedbeds, pods, and fruit, written with Terry Dunn Chase. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so please join me in welcoming them. Thanks for coming. So first, I just wanted to ask a few questions. I've been reviewing the books for a couple weeks, really looking at them. And I was curious, as a photographer myself, and with the title of the show, the idea of From Seed to Sky, Micro and Macro Perspectives, I wanted to start with asking kind of literally where you are when you're making these photographs. So I'll start with you, Carol.
Where I am when I'm making photographs of towers varies greatly. I can be on the tarmac at an airport, standing right underneath the tower. In other places, I'm at the very top of a parking garage in a public area looking at the tower. I have a photograph that I'll show you where I'm out in the snow in Sweden. So the perspective varies, and sometimes also, for one of them, I was in a helicopter. So it depends on the access that I can get to the tower, the time of day, and the availability of an escort, if I need an escort to the tower.
This work?
Yeah.
Hello. I don't need an escort. I tried taking pictures outdoors for several series of books on flowers and trees and seeds, and it's difficult to organize things outdoors, and I really wanted to see what life was like with a plant. So I brought them inside. I built a studio, and I started with a white light table, actually, and kind of like the old botanical artist, and actually would did sort of technical things to sort of had a camera that moved on a motor so I could take different focal points, and then I had software to put it together so I had infinite depth of field. Everything is sharp. So in this case, I'm in the studio, and these are maple samara seeds, and they're plants that fly, which is Now we've connected the airport tower.
Okay. Also on the idea of perspective, kind of, oops, we lost our photo, but I'll ask the question. On the idea of perspective, how did you find yourself photographing airport towers, like your life perspective?
Okay, so Stacy's asking my life perspective, yeah. How did I find myself photographing airport towers? So I have two lives. I have my professional life and my personal life. And in my professional life, as Stacy said, this is my fourth book. I work at the National Air and Space Museum, so my field is aviation. But my former book was called In Plain View, Abstractions of Flight. And so when I was working on that project and I was looking at everything in a very abstract form, that when I, the story goes, I was taking a flight up to New York and literally looked out the window and looked at the tower. And it had this smooth, creamy concrete texture and these circular windows. And I just said, oh, holy crap, it looks like Swiss cheese. And I knew right then I had another project. And so it was a way for me to bring these monumental structures back into the museum as artifacts. So I was photographing them from an artistic point of view, but also documenting the towers as well. But from a personal point of view, in terms of, I think, what attracted me to the towers, I had some challenges, and I think that I was looking at the towers. I thought about this today, because Stacy asked us these questions a couple days ago. I was looking at them as actual guideposts, as these really kind of grounded structures in the airport environment, and to me, they had a powerful presence. And so not only was I photographing these for museum purposes, I found myself really I liked being around these towers. And it was ironic in that here they are the epitome of safety and safe keeping. And again, like the mother caring for her flock. So for me, I guess I felt very comfortable and grounded in the presence of the tower. So I do feel that my purposes were twofold. However, I usually just talk about the professional purposes.
What's the question?
The question was, how did you find yourself photographing seeds?
I had a garden writer, Nancy Hugo, said, would you like to photograph the remarkable trees of Virginia and travel 20,000 miles. And I said, sure, not realizing that it was 100 trees is a lot of trees. Anyway, I was photographing trees, and I had always seen them as a photographer, I'd seen them as objects in the landscape. You know, they were shapes, and you would organize your shapes. And one day, it just dawned on me that they were alive. And I got really interested in their life, this civilization. And just realizing that there's another civilization living on Earth with us. And in a lot of ways, they do better than we do. They live longer. So we ran into a series of books, because I got into the trees, and then I got into the flowers of the trees and the seeds and just the whole life cycle. And someone asked me once, you know, why did I focus on the natural world? And which sort of goes to Carolyn, you know, with her towers. I think there is only a natural world. We are a civilization living on the world, and we make towers, and they're natural. I mean, if I brought you a bird's nest, you would say that was natural, but it's a structure built by birds. So, sum it all up, so my mission is to, with photography, I find myself on Earth, to explore Earth, bring back samples. I don't know where I'm going to bring them back to. But really, to see what you know, suddenly you realize you're on a planet. Why, if you were on another planet right now, you would act differently. You would really look around. You would really see what was there, what was going on. And so here we are, we've evolved, we're humans. we built towers, and the plants have evolved with us. And we sort of are interdependent. We need each other. And so I really am exploring that.
I'm curious about the projector before we go to the next, because you guys could get up and do the presentations now. But it's
a little... I believe your laptop went to sleep.
What was that?
Can you check your laptop to see if it went to sleep?
Laptop was on.
The laptop is asleep.
Laptop is showing image.
Laptop is not asleep.
Laptop is not sleeping.
As we're talking about the laptop, we can talk about the book. But another thing that always kind of fascinates me is the idea that you guys have referred to organization and kind of collecting and going through and making many photographs of these concepts, many photographs of seeds, many photographs of airport towers. Can you kind of maybe address the process of organization? This might be a little bit of the nerdy boardy part of, oh, look, we might be saved. But the organization, how that image kind of comes into the printed page.
Yes, mine will be pretty fast.
Uh-huh.
So I photographed most of these towers digitally. I started off with film, digital, various cameras. But for me, it was a digital process, bringing it into the computer. I did have to sort out whether or not I wanted to go black and white with this project, color. And then in the end, I did choose a desaturated color for mm-hmm. these photographs. Mm-hmm. And in terms of organization, as Robert knows, it's always, at least for me, it's always a struggle going yeah. through my photographs and choosing the best. And so I worked with a very talented designer. Her name is Mine Suda. She's Japanese, and she works for the Pace McGill Gallery up in New York City. And we worked together to sequence the photographs for the book.
Mm-hmm. I used to publish my own books, and when we did the Trees book, we actually raised funds and hired designers and hired printers, and which is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And so the last series of books I've done it with a publisher, and they do everything. Mm-hmm. You get less money. But so there's two ways to do it. But what was interesting about the Remarkable Trees book is that we raised the money to do it. Everyone loves trees, so they gave us money to do the book. And they actually gave us money to reprint the book. And we ran out of money and said, UVA Press distributed it, and they had turned the book down because it's too expensive to print color books. And we said, we can't reprint it. They said, okay, we'll reprint it. So, you know, if you're a famous, you know, mystery author or something, you know, you print on like nothing paper, and you know, they cost a few cents to print a book. But when you print on four color printing on fine paper, it's the unit cost is very expensive. So the publishers are really, really shy about jumping in. As Warren Buffett said, don't test the water with both feet. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. All right. Well, thank you. I'm going to come back later and ask some questions and hope you guys form some questions as well. We'll end with a question and answer, but now I'm going to turn it over to Carolyn and let her show some of our photographs. And Bob, if you and I can step down and look and watch if you want.
So first I would... Yep, I'm good here. I'd like to start first by saying that... this is a book, and then it's also an exhibition. The exhibition's at the National Air and Space Museum for a full year, and then it travels. And with our exhibitions, we have sponsors that sponsor our projects at the Smithsonian. Early on, I didn't have sponsorship, but later on, I was able to have six terrific sponsors: Thales, Saab, Rockwell Collins, NATCA, ACHA and Harris Corporation sponsored the exhibition, and we're always very grateful for that at the Smithsonian. One of the questions Stacy was going to ask was something about the cover of our books. Where were we for the cover of our books? And so this is the cover of my book, and where I actually was in it is right here. And when you pick up the book back on the table, if you open it up, the full spread of the jacket goes to actually this picture, and this is in Scotland. And it was funny, at the time when the sky opened up like that, I knew right then and there that was going to be the cover, even though I wasn't even finished with the project. I still had many more towers to go. So in this project, I started in 2006, and I just finished it this year. Hence, I didn't have funding in the beginning of the project. I photographed over 85 towers. I have 85 towers in the book, and I have 50 in the exhibition, and I traveled to 23 different countries. But at the beginning of the project, I originally thought it was just going to be American towers, so I'm just going to go through some of these. This is the Alliance Tower. This is in Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. And to me, this looks like a stork. And right here in the beak section, it is hiding all of its equipment underneath. So in this project, I have domestic towers, international towers, and then a couple military towers. This is at Edwards Air Force Base in California. And with this tower, out at Edwards, they do a lot of test flying, and this actually has an escape system that comes out of the tower. It is like a crane that comes out and has a gigantic pair of pants, and the controller would jump into those pants and it would bring them down to the ground. So it's called the high-rise escape system. This is in Birmingham. This is the Birmingham Tower in the United Kingdom. And with these towers, I was trying to pull out some of the graphic elements in the towers. So I was looking at towers for their shapes, for what they resembled to me. You'll see in a lot of these, some of them represent animals to me, going back to the natural world that Robert was talking about. And just pulling out their striking characters. So whereas Robert is, you know, focusing on the details of his seeds, in a weird way, I'm doing the same thing with these gigantic structures, and I think it's interesting the two of us are talking today. This is National Airport. Oops, I think I just did something. Let's see. Oh, I have another one of those cords if you need it. I have this on my laptop, too, if you want to stick it in my laptop. Here it is. That's back. So this is National Airport. And so in the beginning of the project, I started locally. And I had the idea in 2006, but I had no idea how I was going to photograph towers. And so we have these terrific dinners at the National Air and Space Museum, and there was a gentleman seated at my table with FAA on his name tag. And so we just got talking towers throughout the course of the evening. And at the end of the night, I said, "Would you happen to know who I can speak to at the FAA for permission?" And he just had this big grin on his face, and with a smile, he said, "That would be me." And unbeknownst to me, I was speaking with the acting administrator for the FAA, Bobby Sturgill. And from that point on, he helped me with access to towers in the United States. So I worked with their public affairs department. And for National Airport, it allowed me to work out all of the kinks as well in terms of what type of camera equipment I wanted to use. And this was in the winter, and one of my cameras, digital cameras, it was a Hasselblad actually, the batteries got cold and the camera wouldn't work. So I was able, you know, I realized I need ham warmers in my camera bag. So. And this is a close-up of the Edinburgh Tower. And these lines on the tower, this is actually a drainage system for the tower. So like I said, in the beginning of the project, I didn't have the funding, and so I got to these towers whatever means possible. So I was given a talk over in Scotland on some of my work at the Smithsonian, and I knew I wanted to photograph this tower, so I went over there to do the talk, and that's how I did the tower. Other ways, we have a research fund that funded the some of the trips. In Plain View, which was my former exhibit, was a traveling show, and the venue fee would come back into a pot of money to use that to travel. And so it was really a hodgepodge trying to get to all of these different places up until the end. This is the Vienna Tower in Austria. And again, I'm looking at the graphic elements of this. And also, the sky was very important to me in these photographs, what the sky was doing in the background. This is the JFK Tower in New York, and to me it looks like a swan. And for some of these properties with JFK, I needed a $10 million insurance certificate to be on their property. So that's quite a contrast from Robert, just walking into your own studio. This is the Farnborough Tower, and to me it looks like a bird in flight. And this is one of the oldest airports in the UK. I think it is their oldest airport. This is Bilbao. And this is in Abu Dhabi. And this is where I really feel that these towers are symbolic. To me, they were like cultural greeters as well. When you land at an airport, you see the tower. It's the first thing that you see, and it's this non-judgmental character. And to me, this crescent shape of the Abu Dhabi Tower, it is supposed to be representative of the dhow boat, which is a cultural icon, the sail of the boat. But to me, it looked like the traditional dress of the man in his robe flowing across the desert. And this is the east-west facade of the tower. So they take on different characters when you move around them. So in 2009, I was invited by the U.S. Embassy in Finland, in Helsinki, to come over and talk about some of my former work in Plain View. And so they arranged this speaking engagement around the country, and I asked, would it be possible if I tried photographing towers in Finland? And so they helped me arrange these visits, and this was the opening to the international arena of airport towers. And I strongly needed to include these towers. Like I said in the beginning, you know, it was, U.S. was on my plate. I thought, oh, how would I ever do this around the world because of all the security requirements? But once I got Finland on board, the other towers really wanted to be part of this project. So this is Joensuu in Finland. And this is Oulu. And this is the Oslo Tower in Norway. And to me, this looks like the human spine. So again, where Robert's talking about the natural world with the seeds, in a weird way, I'm trying to bring the natural world into these objects. And I guess anthropomorphize them. This is the tower at Stockholm, and here's a great example of form and function. As you can see, the lower part of this rooftop, that metal is representational of an airplane wing. They really incorporate the design. Around the column of the tower, they actually have a Finnish artist wrote the words of the Southern Mail, which is an aviation book, a very famous aviation book. At the top of the tower, those two circles, those are representative. The designer had in mind two birds from Nordic mythology looking over the world. Now, at the top of the tower, they also use it for weddings. You can actually get married at the top of the tower, and it includes champagne, chocolate, and a VIP ride to your honeymoon destination. So obviously, that's not where the controllers sit, but I thought that was pretty cool. So this is Sweden, form and function. And then this is also in Sweden. This is one of the one of Saab's towers. This is a remote tower. These are the newest towers on the market, so to speak. This is the new technology. And as you can see, there's not a controller up at the top. Up at the top, it is sensors and video cameras, and the controllers can sit 100 miles away in front of 360 degrees of LCD screens. So I just came back from Madrid. Last week, I was in Madrid at a World Air Traffic Management Conference. And this is really, really the talk of the town. We do have a remote tower out in Leesburg. That's one of the first ones here in the United States. I'm not saying all towers are going in this direction, but this is something that we're going to see more and more of. And this is me. This is minus 25 Celsius in Sweden. This is the Heathrow Tower. And to me, it looks like a gentleman's top hat. So you can say it's either a gentleman's top hat, or you can see, for me, it also has a little bit of the crucifix with those lines spread out. And for this property, I had to have a $20 million insurance certificate to be on their runways. And so whenever I'm out on the tarmac, I'm always escorted. I always have a special vest on. And you know exactly where you can step and where you can't step. You always have to be in the eye of the driver that takes you out there. And that's just a reminder that these places, they are a little bit dangerous when you have these moving aircraft around you. This is in Frankfurt, and this is a cheat shot. I didn't ask for permission to photograph this tower, and this was actually taken through the window in the terminal. A lot of my flights go through Frankfurt. But for me, it was almost a good thing, because with the distance, you really get perspective. And I wouldn't have had that perspective of all of those folds and all of those zigzags if I had access. Of course, I'd want to be right underneath the tower. You always think, the closer you are to this thing, the better picture you're going to get. But that's a little lesson I use in life, too. Sometimes you need to get some distance to get perspective on just about anything. This was in China. This was another place where I didn't have permission. I was over there for the Li Shui Photo Festival. I was one of 30 Westerners invited to this, and this was a shot I was able to get from a taxi. And you'll see in the book, I have a second picture of this one. There's a whole advertisement with some people playing ping pong on the side of their tower. This is Singapore. This is Changi. And of course, what you asked about perspective of towers, it is a challenge to make sure that you're not getting the same shot over and over again. And so for this one, I did want something to frame it in the forefront to kind of give it a little bit of an Asian flair. And where I was, if you see in this picture, those little things that look like flowers, that is a fire escape of a Crown Plaza Hotel that was nearby. I went in and I asked the manager if I could get in there and use that as kind of the foreground for my towers. This is a tower in Malaysia. This is an example in their airport. They say airport in the forest, forest in the airport, and they built their tower to look like a tree. I do have the world's tallest tower. That's also in the book, and that's Malaysia's second tower. Used to be Thailand's. That one's in there, too. This is Dubai. And to me, this looked like a spider or some type of insect. And so the way I group these photographs in the exhibition downtown is I put pictures that had the graphic elements together, or pictures that kind of look like animals or insects together. And in some ways also, it varied on the atmosphere. So I did curate them aesthetically. This is the Sydney Tower, and of course, they have these circles up at the top, and what that does is it replicates for the Olympic rings. So they built their tower right before the Olympics came to Sydney. So this was the tower that I was talking about with the smooth, creamy concrete and the black windows. And to me, it looked like Swiss cheese. This is LaGuardia. And when I first started the project, this was an active tower. But toward the end of the project, they got a new tower, and the top of this tower was chopped off, losing its artistic integrity forever. And so this is now a historic tower. And so in the book, I have contemporary towers and historic towers. I have them separated because I feel that I photograph them quite differently. And they're also, and I'm photographing them for a different purpose. I'm really photographing them to call attention to their preservation, or you know, what can we do with these towers? How can we save them? Can we repurpose them? And I just have a couple of examples here. This is a beauty, and this is a tower in Barcelona, 1965. Another way of finding these towers, I had all these wish lists. I do a ton of research, but sometimes you find these towers by surprise. You're on the airport grounds to photograph one tower, and then you're there driving around. It's like, oh, what is that over there? And they had two other towers. So sometimes you would find them that way. This is Pearl Harbor, which withstood the attacks of World War II. And for me, this picture, it helped me realize that I didn't want to go full black and white with this picture. I really liked the darkened skies, but I wanted a little bit of that rainbow to show hope. And a black and white rainbow just doesn't do it for me. So I think it was probably this picture that I knew I needed to hold a little bit of color. This is the tower in Abu Dhabi. This is their older tower, and they didn't want me to photograph it. They asked me not to, but I photographed it anyways, and I think to show them how important and how beautiful this tower is. It's not just about the newest and the best towers. This is in Lemnos, Greece. And again, this says what's to become with this tower, we really don't know. Some of the older towers were repurposed for businesses, museums. This one is, we don't know what the fate of this tower is. And I'll leave you with this last slide. This is my last slide so Robert can talk about his project. This is a tower. This is East Fortune in Scotland. And here it is repurposed for the sake of the farmer to park his tractor here. So thank you.
So now we'll be moving over to Robert Llewellyn, Seeing Seeds.
Doesn't work. And it works. do I have to hit a space bar or something? How do you drive?
There are these four things, and you go not that way.
Left. Just left. The right one.
Yeah, there.
The other right.
Yeah, that.
There. Okay, I like to walk around. This is a catalpa tree in Kenmore. Some of you may have been there, but I was there with the writer, Nancy, and this is one of the trees we did for the 100 trees in Virginia. And I was really looking at the flowers, and so I went a little closer, and they really look like orchids. So I went a little closer. And this is where we get to tie into Carolyn's towers. Because what Nancy told me was, this is a control tower. Because I asked her, I said, what are these lines for? Why does the flower have lines on it? And she said, oh, that guides the insects into the flower. And I went, oh, my God. So you can sort of see the flower going,
Bumblebee Heavy, you're cleared on runway 26.
I mean, it was just like, it's like the Earth shifted in orbit a little bit. For me, that they have a plan. This is not random. This is not pretty flowers. This is, they want insects to come there. They want to have children. So that was really started the odyssey of the seeds. But what's interesting is the transformation. So that white flower turns into this. You've seen, this is over on Rugby Road. You've probably seen these long cigar things. Kids used to smoke them as cigars. And it's like they don't need the flower anymore. We're on to other business. So that little white flower turns into foot-long seed pods. So I brought them home. I took them apart. They dry up. When they're green, you cut them open, and they're just green inside. And then they dry up, and it's like, wait a minute. There's beings living in there. And then one day, the wind blows, and you can sort of see the catalpa tree going, goodbye. Stay in school, get a job, don't take drugs. I mean, these are plants that fly, and then this is their method. Track the bumblebee, get pregnant, have your children. One day the wind disperses the trees. I mean, a masterful plan. I'll do another one. Anyone know what this is? Tiger? Tiger lily? Huh? Blackberry lily, okay. It is. And when the flower dries up, it looks like this. So you have a bunch of flowers here, and they're like having a big party, and they invite the insects in. And sort of each flower has its own kind of insect it attracts. And then this incredible transformation from these orange flowers to, it looks like blackberries. Why would it look like blackberries? So the bears like blackberries. they come eat these seeds. And of course you know what bears do in the woods. So the blackberry lily sends its seeds throughout the woods. And it's just more and more as it is, each plant has its own little system, its own little plan. But I mean, what a mimic. I mean, doesn't it look like a blackberry? This is my favorite story. This is a castor bean, and Jefferson grew them at Monticello because they had big, huge leaves, and they would sort of shade the garden, and they're beautiful plants. They're tropical plants. They're illegal in some states because, actually, it's really interesting. This sort of looks like the hazmat symbol. This is the flower of the castor bean. Inside are three seeds, which are deadly poisonous. And that's the three seeds. And the plant actually explodes and shoots the seeds like 30 feet. And I think at Monticello, they cut the flowers off before they bloom. So I got really interested in the seed and just the patterns and everything. I wrote to the botanist in Richmond. I said, why do they have camouflage on them? And he said, I don't know. Anyway, so I did more research. Inside of the seed is two things, castor oil and ricin. Ricin is the most poisonous thing in the world. It's like 10,000 times more than rattlesnake venom. One molecule of ricin will kill a human cell. They actually killed a Belgian diplomat with it on the tip of an umbrella. So The catharmine is not trying to kill you. It's trying to keep you from eating its children. Five of them will kill a horse. The castor oil is the slipperiest oil in the world. It will, even in race cars, because it's so slippery. It kind of burns up, so they have to rebuild the engine afterwards, but it doesn't matter. So I followed the story more, and on the very tip is a little piece of fat. Well, that's kind of odd. And I looked it up in Google. It's not connected to the seed. It's attached to the seed, but it's not part of the seed. So the seed gets shot out 30 feet, lands on the ground. Ants come along, say, oh, castor bean seed. They take the seed down into the ant burrows, and they take off that little piece of fat and feed it to their young. Very nutritious. Then they take the seed and dispose of it in their refuse bin, which is underground. What a plan. I'm just floored by how much we don't know about this world. Here's another quick one. I mean, you know what these are. These are red cedars, and they're all over the place. And these are actually ancient plants. These are not really berries. They're cones, and they don't taste very good. The birds sort of eat them at the end of the season when there's nothing else to eat. But when they eat them and then fly and land on the fences of Albemarle County, this is what happened. Another plan. So, one thing about doing these books, doing these projects, is that I never see the world the same again, the same way. You know, I drive down the road and I see these cedar trees, and it's just like, there's these plans going on. There's a lot going on out there. So I have my white light table. It's much like the botanical drawings. This is called Devil's Claw, for obvious reasons. There are four seeds here. To me, this is the most beautiful seed pod in the world. I talk to students sometimes, photography students, and I tell them to take more than one picture. Try to look at things in lots of different ways. And this is a good example, because it's a three-dimensional object. This thing is about
this big.
It's about this big. And these are razor sharp. They will draw blood. And they're designed to catch on to the hooves of hooved animals and be carried for miles. And eventually the center part gets crushed and the seeds have been distributed. But I just want to show how much fun I have. So I put this thing on the light table, so what am I going to do? And it's just, there's so many. I had brought the others. Anyway, there's. I mean, that's just an exquisite structure to distribute seeds. They also grow these at Monticello, so you can go see them. They say that we have red blood that, because of iron. Plants have green blood because of magnesium. They're not that different. But this is the seed right here. This Carolyn, is aircraft. seeds that fly. But, I mean, doesn't it look so human? I find these in my backyard. You know, this is not something that I don't have to go to Abu Dhabi. And this is the lowly dandelion, of course. And actually, if you get close to it, it's a pretty complicated structure. And then one day it explodes, and again, goodbye, children. And they're off on little parachutes. They actually have parachutes. And there's always one that says, but mommy, I don't want to go. I want to stay here. It's a very invasive plant. And acanthus, tree of heaven or something, but it really isn't. It's, but the flying seeds can account for populating themselves quite prolifically. And even though it's an invasive plant, it's quite beautiful. These are on the tree now. If you go on the sycamores, this is the fruit ball, and it stays on the tree all winter. And I can't reach it. The little red thing there, that's put in there in the winter, but that's next spring's leaves. And if you cut that open, it'll be green inside. And these balls hang on this tree for all winter, and you see they're sort of frayed. And right now they're starting to blow apart. So each one of these is a sycamore tree. And when the winds come up, you'll find these everywhere. So it's one of the things I would like my books to do is sort of change just sort of how you walk around, how you look at things, and maybe collect things. This is how far I had to go. This is the larkspur. And there's the flower, and there's the seed pod. And the seed is the size of the period at the end of a sentence. And I thought, well, how am I going to photograph this? You know, it's really tiny. It's like dust. So I got a microscope lens. And so I do this thing where I photograph at the top, and I focus there, and then I shoot different layers all the way down. And with a larkspur seed, I had to do 100 frames. So I never got to see it in focus. I just saw bits of it. And I put it in the software in the computer. And it renders, kind of like an MRI, it renders the image. And this is the image you get. I thought it was a black dot. And I wrote to the professor at Richmond, I said, it looks like a jellyfish, you know, what is that for? And he says, I have no idea. These are opium poppies, and they grow these at Monticello too, although apparently the DEA had some fuss with them about it. And they come out of little you can see the seeds, they're in little skylights, kind of like airport towers, and they blow in the wind. And if you eat a Botus bagel, poppy seed bagel, you will be tested positive for opium. Just saying. They're really good. This is arugula, and they're little incubators that they keep their children in. Then one day, it's goodbye. This goes on forever. The editor at Timber Press, which I did this book, he sent me a list of sort of selected choices, and then I looked it up, and there are 240,000 plants in the world that produce seeds. So this is the money plant, but again, it looks so human. It looks like blood vessels, and even like down to the little umbilical cords that connect to the seeds. You've seen these down, some down by McGuffey, but they're Osage orange. And I wanted to get one that had the female tendrils. So I found someone that had access to them and they could get it with a ladder. Phil Marks, he climbed up the ladder and he cut it for me. And I drove home and all the tendrils had gone. You know, what to do. And I realized it had milky sap in it. So I went back and climbed the tree again, and I took a blowtorch, and I sealed the end of it. So I got this picture. The tree is pressurized. And each little dot there is a seed. And you'll find that plants with milky sap are generally poisonous. And, this one definitely has milky sap. So I'd cut things open, see what was inside. I mean, it's almost like a little kid having fun. These are right outside my door. I mean, just such beautiful structures. And you can see, you know, the flowers, and they got to get the bees to come. Or pollen, and trees are pollinated by wind usually, but you know, this little guy got left out. Anyone know what this is?
No.
Nah. You remember this is a vegetable you wouldn't eat when you were a child? Oh, cry, yeah, everybody got it. these are from Lewis Skinner Botanical Gardens. They grow flowers to show children where their food comes from, even though they want to eat the okra. This one explodes also into these beautiful seeds, and you can't really see it here, but there's these incredible little designs on the seeds. Again, I have no idea why. And some plants, they don't do seeds, they make little bublets like Egyptian onions. And you just get these beautiful shapes. I mean, I don't really know what's going on here, but you know, if you took this and planted one of these, you'd get another onion. But they also have flowers and they also make seeds. So they're really going out to get their species spread across the planet. And it's a really good thing because you ate seeds this morning. And if it wasn't for these angiosperm plants that produce seeds full of starch and protein and sugars, we would have a hard time having enough food, if at all. So these plants occurred first, and they gave rise to warm-blooded mammals like us. This is echinacea. It's used as a lot of the plants are used as drugs. And we wear some of them. A lot of people are wearing cotton. Seed balls. Seed pods. And then they open up. Beautiful. And lotus. I grew these myself. And these are like rock hard in their little chambers, but they dug some up in China, 1,000 years old. They carbon dated them, and they scratched them and put them in water, and some of them grew. So they can survive 1,000 years. So these were the seeds I photographed, and just they really like people. I mean, they're all seeds, and they're all children of the plants, but they're different, like we are. That's a collection of all the ones I photographed. So now I'm working on another book called Seeing the Forest. So I'm out of the studio. And this is another great adventure. It's just I feel like humans need missions, and it's like having a mission. And you see this spiral. This Fibonacci spiral occurring a lot in plants, and of course, you know, it's part of humans also. But it's that was one more picture. It's not there. So thank you. The last picture. I had a picture of the. A galaxy, because it's the same shape as the. That's okay. I just left it out. Y'all know what a galaxy looks like.
It's in the galaxy. Thank you, Bob, Robert, and thank you, Carolyn. So that was really interesting to see the different perspectives from your backyard to around the world and how you two see so differently, but also feel and see similar things as you work. So we're going to open up to the floor for some questions. So does anybody have any questions they'd like to start with?
Well, those are stunning photographs. Thank you both for showing us. It's really terrific. I have a question for Carolyn, and it's more architectural. I mean, I was struck that there were so few older towers, and I suppose that older towers, like the ones that you showed us at the very end, get decommissioned or torn down, and what we have left are ones that are more recently built. That was a question.
I just showed you a couple of older towers. Sorry. There are still many older towers left. Sorry. But again, like I said, I feel like the older towers are kind of eyewitnesses to aviation, and I feel that we should try and preserve them or see if we can keep them around as long as we can, because they're part of the story in aviation, part of the story at the airports. Not quite sure what your question was, and were you comparing that to the more contemporary towers? A lot of times they tear down the older towers to build the newer towers.
That's what I was asking. You know, as an ordinary traveler, you can't get as close to the tower as you've been able to do. And so my memories, especially from when I started traveling in the 60s, where there were a lot of older towers around, and, you know, they'd show maybe some Art Deco architecture or something like that. And so my question was whether they're all gone or whether they're in your book. And
well, know. Some of them are in my book. For instance, in Kansas and Wichita, that is an example of one of the Art Deco towers, and that has been repurposed into the Kansas Aviation Museum. There is another one in Ohio, and it's in Cincinnati, I believe. And although it is on the historic preservation list, it is one of the most endangered towers. One of the most endangered buildings in Ohio. So in some cases they're still around, but I think in many cases they're torn down. And in the book, I have actually the demolition of a tower. So the whole series of the tower being torn down.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you both for coming today. It's really interesting to hear you and for the correlation between the towers and the seeds. I thought that was the landing and the transport. I think the tying together of the two themes is wonderful. But Robert, I'm interested in can you talk about any seeds or plants where your mind was blown in a way and you feel like you learned something or the structure was so beyond belief for you? Just anything that sort of was really surprising in the end with the project.
Well, actually, getting close to any of these, it sort of blows your mind. It's just like, this is hiding in plain sight. This is right in front of you. This is on the walk right outside the building, and you don't see it. You walk by it, you don't see it. I mean, if you go outside right now in the walkway, it's covered in seeds. They're all the plants. They're there doing their thing. The one adventure I did have is I had a euphorbia plant, and I was trying to arrange it on the light table. So a lot of my work is like flower arranging, but I cut it with an X-Acto knife and arranged it. And unfortunately, I do this a lot. I rub my eye with the milky sap, and I realized that I couldn't see out of that eye. And so with the other eye, I ran to Google. Which is a lot easier than going down to the library and the card catalog. And it said that it will blind you. I said, well, that's not good news. But it said if you wash it out with cream, you can save your eye. So I ran, and I had half and half, so I ran to the shower, and I have my sight. But it went on to say that one person was cutting him in his garden, and he got a big glob on his eye, and he lost his cornea. What blows my mind is the extent that the plant goes to protect. It's protecting its babies, really. It's just the mother bear and the cubs at the end of the day.
And Just one more comment for Carolyn. I just think your project is interesting. Did you, because you have a destination, which is the tower, and did you just like turn right around after you photographed them? To actually, your destination being the airport is really funny to me. But were you able to?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. In a couple of cases, yeah. What I tried to do though is when I went out to do a trip, for instance, in the Pacific, I did. Sydney, and I did, so I went from Sydney to Tasmania, flew in, flew out in one day, Tasmania, just for the tower. Then I would go to Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, I did, just flew in, flew out. So in certain circumstances, yeah, I would just fly in for the tower, and it was exhausting. Those days, because you know you're just with your equipment and you're all adrenaline up and you're just shooting like crazy, and then you gotta pack it all up and get back on the plane. And so I didn't do them all like that. I would rest, and then in a destination I would also try to find other towers within driving distance too. So a lot of times like for Australia, I did three towers in the same area, and that's how I tried to work, so I could get as many towers as possible.
So, Carolyn, you mentioned in the case of a couple of the Nordic towers that there was some symbolism behind them. I wondered if you had the opportunity to dialogue with airport authorities or whoever it is, the local governments that may have built the towers, because clearly there was a concept or an image or an idea behind that that maybe they had and conveyed to the architect. And did you have the opportunity, perhaps maybe not flying in or flying out, but in some cases, did you have the opportunity to dialogue with those folks and perhaps even with the architect in terms of that interplay? Because what Robert is showing us is the natural process, but the object you're photographing is also the result of a process. It's almost a creative process between a conceptual idea and the execution of that idea by an architect. So I wondered if that was an area that you might have followed up on in some cases.
Yeah, and it is an area that you have to follow up on, because at the towers, you're dealing with air traffic controllers, and obviously the architects and the designers were there many years prior. So at the airports, you could talk to the public affairs people about the designers, but for instance, Steve Wakeman of Jacobs, he is the architect for the Phoenix Tower, and I was able to follow up and get some information from him, and he's actually coming to the museum next week for a personal tour from me. But with his tower out in Phoenix, Frank Lloyd Wright was his inspiration for organic architecture. And in that particular tower, the colors of the tower do match the rocks and the environment in Arizona. So some of the architects obviously do have backstories to their designs. And then some of them, we have a lot of the cookie cutter type towers here in the U.S., and again, that's primarily for function. So to answer your question, in some cases, yes, I was able to follow up with the architects. In the book, there are little stories on each of the towers, and some of them cover the design aspects, some of them cover the history of the airport, or maybe just, a little nuance of something that happened at that airport. So there's little stories that go with each tower, and that's what we have in the text.
A question for both. Carolyn, you must have looked at the notion of the human element to this enterprise and made purposely stayed away from that and any interiors or anything like that. And I just wondered about that decision, and you're probably the queen of red tape about now of having gone through all this, and what another level that would have been to get interiors. But that whole world of it would be pretty fetching, I would think.
In a lot of these towers, I was invited up into the tower once they met me, and I did make a conscious choice, though, that I did not want to do the interiors of the towers. To me, it wasn't as interesting for me. I like the views outside of the towers, and I kind of started another project from actually the interior of the tower, but looking out, just the very beginning of a project. It's not real yet. I also did not want to be a security risk in terms of getting my access to the exterior of the tower by asking for both up front. So, yes, I made a decision that I really wanted to do the exterior structures. Did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. And, Bob, to Stacy's earlier questions about sequencing, because you obviously ceded control of this project by having a publisher and not doing what you have done in the past. And were you fine with however they want to put them down for sequencing, or it must have been hard to give up that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. And some other people, and I was talking to the audience that have had books published, yes. So there is nothing like being able to do it all yourself and do it exactly the way you want. And you have to figure the publishers are looking at. I mean, for the seed book, I shot 1,000 pictures, and they used 200 and some. So I like all 1,000 of them. So they pick them for what's good, and they know their market, what's going to appeal to their market, and maybe they're plants that people grow and they're used to, and you know they'll get to see them themselves. I don't know the answers to that. I offered to go out and help, and all I got was crickets. You know, just chirp chirp. But so it was okay. But they take over the whole thing, and they market the book, and they, you know, they get it in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and I don't want to do that. You know, I've done some of that, and I feel like I'm an artist, and I want to be a marketing person. And it's always been a tough struggle for all artists in dealing with the doing it for a livelihood. You know, doing it, getting royalties. And, I mean, Carolyn's different. She works for the Smithsonian. She's secure. That's the ideal way. you can go out and do your project and not worry about whether it's going to be a good livelihood project.
So, Carolyn, were you involved in finding your sponsors?
Yes. So I would like to speak.
Sorry.
I would like to speak to that. The sponsors and the book publisher are two different things, but yes, I was actively involved. We do have a terrific advancement department in our museum who actually, you know, makes the official approaches, but what I did was I went to air traffic control conferences to see who was sponsoring these conferences. I walk the floor, I compile a list, and I present that list to our advancement folks and say, hey, these might be some good people, and of course our advancement department already has relationships with a couple of them. So two of them they had started a relationship with over other projects. So that's one part of the project, but the publishing is very different, and this year is the first year I used Smithsonian Books as my publisher. In the past, I always went outside the Smithsonian, so I used Bulfinch, Abrams, and Powerhouse Books, and I feel that the marketing is very important to have along with your book package. I think it's okay to talk to people about your project, and I think it's good because we're doing these projects for ourselves and putting them into these books. I think we also want other people to hear our message, and I think marketing is a good way that we're telling the story that we're trying to portray in our photography. But back to artistic control with the publishers, I was very specific about this particular designer that I had. I had her last time with Powerhouse Books, which is an art photography publisher up in New York, and I made that part of my contract that I wanted this same designer to work with her again. I also made it specific what type of paper I wanted. We had some ideas for the cover. If you look at the cover, there's some silver lettering. And at one point, they kind of said, oh, well, I don't think we're going to go with the silver. And I was like, well, yes, we are. So I'm very specific when it comes to kind of the control over the end product. And then in getting back to editing, I mean, I have thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures of towers, and it is a pity you can't use them all, but you do have to edit. I mean, because otherwise, I think it would be a chore for somebody to have to go through that many pictures. I think it is our responsibility to try to kind of weed out, you know, the best that we can do to represent something. So for me, I love the bookmaking process. From beginning to end, that's just as much part of what I like to do as shooting the project, so, and the exhibition process as well.
Thank you very much. For the audience, the visual experience is obviously very important. I don't know if you two up there can see this monitor over here, but the image on that and the image up there is so strikingly different.
Welcome to our world.
Yeah, I mean, which one is closer to the reality of what you think your images really show? And if it's that one, maybe that would be a better one to put up for the audience instead of that one. What? That's a question.
Well, I mean, all projectors and screens have different color palettes, and the interfaces are crazy. And every time I give a talk, I'm always terrified of when the picture goes up, what it's going to look like. And people that travel and give talks all the time with photographs carry their own equipment. So if you want to see what the pictures look like, I would suggest the book in the back of the room.
And I think...
Yes, probably more saturated and darker.
And I think that that's a great ending. Sorry, John Mason, but we want to have the opportunity for book signing in the back. So, yeah, if you really want to see the color, check it out. Or I think you both exhibit as well, so you can look them up and see. Exhibition prints are beautiful as well. So thank everybody. I'm thanking everybody for coming. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you.